that a respected journalist on the job would be able to get to the truth of the incident and report it back to listeners so we would know how best to respond. But when you hear a veteran photojournalist who is on the job at Three Mile Island say,
"There was terrible, terrible information diffusion and cover-up by the three main characters, if you will, in Three Mile Island. Everybody was telling us something different, and we really didn't know who to believe."
When you hear something like that from someone who was there, you start to understand how helpless we will all be to understand the truth of what's happening in case of a nuclear accident. And that's when you start to realize that you are in the seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a very special nuclear hot seat. A report from my trip to Middletown, Pennsylvania, for the 39th anniversary of the nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island. This was my first time back since the accident happened almost 4 decades ago. You will hear from veteran news reporters who covered the story at great risk to their personal health, and from those who have researched the medical impact of the radiation releases to find out what's been happening and why. When the nuclear industry touts nobody died at Three Mile Island, as will be clear to you by the end of this program, people died and continue to die from Three Mile Island. As always, Nuclear Hot Seat provides the nuclear news from a different perspective. Today is Tuesday, April 10, 2018, and here is this week's special, Three Mile Island at 39. WTF actually happened to us. As regular listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat know, I recently returned to Three Mile Island for the 39th anniversary of that nuclear accident. The trip was sparked by the discovery of a new Facebook group, Three Mile Island Survivors, with which I felt great affinity. For the anniversary, the group's founders put together a public panel discussion that included several members of the media who covered the nuclear accident when it happened. I wanted to learn what Three Mile Island looked like to those reporters who did not prove to be immune to the consequences of the story. I arrived on March 28th, the anniversary, and drove to Middletown to retrace my steps from 39 years ago. I engaged people I encountered in conversation, and what I found most amazing was that everyone knew what Three Mile Island was, and those over a certain age knew of the accident or remembered it directly. Having returned to Los Angeles almost immediately after TMI happened, I was used to living in an environment where nobody knew what I was talking about and thought that TMI meant too much information, which was their exact response when I tried to explain about the nuclear accident. But in Middletown, on March 28, when I said I was back for the anniversary, no one asked me what anniversary I was talking about. It wasn't some vague reference point from 4 decades ago. It was personal and familial history. At Cuppy's, a local diner where I had been 39 years ago, the fourth-generation owner cook, two waitresses, and a few of the regulars shared stories of having been in school, their panicked parents coming to pull them out of class, and the following evacuation. They all talked animatedly as they remembered their fear from that time. But when I tried to inquire about the consequences, how their health was, what happened within their families, I received blank stares, tight-lipped shrugs, or outright denials that anything bad had happened because, after all, as the nuclear industry taught us all to say, nobody died at Three Mile Island. At a local senior center, I interrupted card games to ask for memories of the accident. The responses were fairly typical.
My name is Marilyn Moore, and I just started a new job in Middletown, and Three Mile Island went off. I came out of a meeting room with 12 people, and there was a room of 400 correspondents there, and they were all gone. The room was empty, and we said, where did they go? And they said, Three Mile Island's ready to melt down, and we could look out the windows and see it. We were that close, so... And I was the only one reported back to work for the next week because nobody, they all left town and nobody would come to work.
And why did you stay?
I stayed because I had to. I just started the job and didn't have any money yet.
I lived right in line with the 3 mile along the river. When this happened, we were concerned about our dog, more so than we were concerned about ourselves. We took our dog away for over a week. And we packed a suitcase and went to work each day and came home and sat outside. But that's how we lived until the all clear came and we were fine.
When I reported to work and nobody else was there, I was answering phones. A customer called in from out in the Midwest and wanted to know where I was. And I said I was calling from, you know, I was in Pennsylvania. And he said, about 3 Mile Island. He said, did it melt down yet? I said, let me look out the window. I looked out. I said, nope, it's still standing. He said, you can see it from there. I said, yes. He said, why don't you get out of town?
Most considered it old news and didn't want to comment or be recorded. But one woman pulled me aside to quickly tell me.
My brother lived downwind, and he died of liver cancer. I blame the 3MI for that, but I don't know.
A couple pulled me aside and quietly confided that their son had died at age 54 after a 15-year battle with cancer. They suspected TMI, but like the others, they had no proof. Maybe that's why they treated this admission as something they needed to keep quiet, as though there was something shameful about it. I came to realize that nothing in that community had radicalized the population enough to support an honest exploration of their fears of what TMI had taken from them and any lingering aftermath from the accident. I mentioned the panel discussion to as many people as I could, but none of them had heard about it, and even once they learned, no one expressed an interest in attending. People acted almost guilty if they expressed any concerns about the accident, and none with whom I spoke seemed to want to learn anything more. Natural reticence? Or learned behavior in response to having heard so repeatedly that nobody died at 3 Mile Island? The panel discussion, which was held the night of March 29th, was put together by local residents and TMI survivors Stacy Griffiths, Christine Lehman, and Joe Rodriguez. About 60 people showed up, everyone from veteran activists affiliated with TMI Alert to first-timers, residents who'd never before considered that maybe, just maybe, the health problems they and their family and friends and neighbors were facing had something to do with that accident down at the end plant. The local cable network showed up to film it, as did panelist Heidi Huttner for an upcoming documentary. Panel members fell into two groups, journalists and researchers. First, the journalists set the stage. Michelle Lefevre-Quinn was a 22-year-old reporter and morning news co-anchor just 8 months into her job with WKBO in Harrisburg when, on March 28, 1979, the accident began.
It was a normal Wednesday on March 28, 1979. In fact, it was a rather slow news period, and we felt we were coasting along. We were getting ready for our last newscast of morning drive time when Captain Dave contacted us and said, something's happening at TMI. And by the way, Mike, there's no steam coming out of the towers. Well, Mike Pintech, being the newsman that he was, knew something was awry. Back then, we tried to verify anything that happened before we reported it. So he had me contact Dauphin County Emergency Dispatch to ask them, and they verified that indeed something was going on at TMI and that fire engines were headed that way. Mike, in the meantime, called TMI and was somehow patched directly into the control room. And the person who answered the phone said, "I can't talk now. There's an emergency. You need to call MedEd in Reading." Mike quickly got on the phone, got a hold of Blaine Fabian from PR at MedEd, and Blaine said that there was an emergency. There was a general emergency at TMI, but there was no danger to the public, and they were working on it. So that is what Mike announced at 8:25 that morning. It was the first news that went out.
Dan Steele is a longtime Pennsylvania broadcaster and radio personality who is co-hosting the morning program at WKBO when he first learned of the story.
Captain Dave broke the story when he called me on the two-way and said, "Dan, I need to talk to Mike Pintech. Something's going on at TMI." So I said, "Mike, pick up the two-way." And then Dave and Mike conversed. Mike got off the two-way microphone, picked up the phone, and called TMI to find out what was going on. It was my understanding at that time that was the first, probably, of a few lies that would be told to us over the years. Kind of like, nothing going on here, nothing to see, keep moving. Don't worry about the thing, we got everything under control. We do have a situation.
Michelle Lefevre Quinn picks up the story.
We were led to believe that everything was fine and it had been contained and it worked exactly the way the nuclear industry said it would work. We came in Thursday. In fact, I spent the day at Fox Market in Middletown interviewing people, asking them what they thought. And the general feeling was that we were lucky, that everything was fine. Friday happened. We were going through our normal newscast. Again, it seemed fine until I remember about 9:30, the AP wire.
You have all, I'm sure, dozens of times seen my video from the helicopter circling over the cooling towers and then getting a call on the radio from air traffic control telling us to get the hell out of the air. They just released radiation.
A rather agitated man in the back of the room shouted out, "Did you have a Geiger counter in the helicopter, and what were the readings?" When Frank Goldstein had a chance to respond, he said,
"I had never seen a Geiger counter. There was no Geiger counter in the helicopter. We, as journalists, and some of the guys at cameras around here know exactly what I'm talking about, we were sent to stories. Very little briefing, and certainly very little safety training or training on anything. And as my colleague to the right will attest, there was certainly nothing having to do with post-traumatic stress or fear or any of those other things that we have dealt with."
As a resourceful journalist, Frank Goldstein did what he could.
When we found out we were going to a potential nuclear issue in Harrisburg, my TV station happens to be across from a hospital. I went over to the radiation department and got those film dosimeters. That's all we had to know how exposed we were. And we were told that there was no issue after they were developed when we returned. But since then, I've learned, and I don't know if it's true, that the isotopes that were released from Three Mile Island, the type of radiation, if you will, may not have even registered on those film dosimeters. So we may have gotten much more of something we don't know anything about. Many, many of my colleagues from Philadelphia, with whom we meet four times a year at a lunch, many, many of them, as a matter of fact, far more of them who have medical issues than do not.
Frank Goldstein. Michelle Lefevre Quinn was sent to the Harrisburg State House to cover Governor Frank Thornburg as the accident continued to unfold. She reported on the suggested evacuation of pregnant women and children within a five-mile radius of Three Mile Island. The announcement I heard coming down the street in the house where I stayed. Michelle continued.
I spent most of the entire day and evening at the state capitol after having been at work at 6 a.m. in the morning, and Mike came to relieve me, and I was petrified. I was 22 years old. I didn't know much about nuclear power. I knew something about radiation, and I was wondering, will I ever have kids? I watched the newsmen in the newsroom get their families out of there, and I was wondering what I was going to do. Mike said I just looked at him and said, what should I do? He said he had never seen such fear in anyone's face. And he told me, I don't know, you do what you have to do.
Dan Steele told us at the top of his presentation that he suffers from PTSD from a combination of an incident in Vietnam as well as Three Mile Island. He was on his way from Harrisburg to a planned job interview in San Antonio, Texas on Friday, March 30th, the third day of the accident, and related this emotional story.
Friday morning, I like to say that was the day that all hell broke loose. I left my wife and the car at the airport and was flying to San Antonio. Well, first of all, the plane sat on the end of the runway at Harrisburg International for 45 minutes. And we kept being told by the pilot that our departure was delayed because of priority aircraft in the air. But I've never heard that before. Flew into San Antonio, and the general manager who was going to interview me for the job said to me, listen, I understand if you want to turn around and go back home. I said, for what? He said, well, because of TMI. And I said, oh, no, that was Wednesday. They got that all taken care of. Nothing to worry about here. And he said, no, don't you know what happened today? And I said, what happened today? And he said, well, Linda, my wife, is okay. She's in New Jersey. And I thought, okay, how did that happen? I found out the story from San Antonio's perspective initially, which was really kind of strange, living in Middletown, Pennsylvania, and finding out that all hell is breaking loose in your hometown. I flew back on Saturday night, changed planes in Chicago, and I got on the plane in Chicago thinking, I'm going to be the only one on this aircraft going to Harrisburg. The plane was full. It was full of journalists. They were all coming to cover the biggest story. We got to the airport and taxis would not come pick us up. Nobody was coming into the airport. Nobody wanted to be that close to TMI that night. This was Saturday night. I was offered a ride by one of the people who were on the plane with me. And he was kind enough to take me home, and it was such an eerie feeling going back into Lower Swidera Township, where our home is in our development, and there was not a single light on anywhere. I called my wife when I got home. I'm sorry. I get emotional about this. I called my wife at home. She was in Jersey, and she told me, well, I'm okay, and our son Scott is okay. The disc jockeys came and got him out of school and brought him home and picked up our car at the airport, and Linda went to New Jersey. And I was reassured my wife was okay, and she said, what can you do? Can you pack up and leave? And I thought, I can't pack up. I'm the program director of the radio station. This is when radio is supposed to shine. I can't leave. We got a job to do. I called Mike Pintek at the radio station. I said, Mike, it's Dan. All I've heard is reporting from San Antonio's perspective. Can you tell me? What's going on? How is it? How bad is it? Mike Pintek's words to me on that evening were, Dan, let me put it this way. I'm prepared to meet my maker. Mike Pintek has cancer today.
Dan Steele sought relief from the relentless pressure of the time, but that was hard to come by.
I'm trying to process all of this information, and I thought, let me turn the television on and see Saturday Night Live. Maybe I'll get entertained. Bob and Ray were filling in that night, and they had a funny monologue. And I thought, oh, well, this is what I really needed to hear. I needed a little entertainment to think about. And right before they broke for the commercial, Ray Goodman said, don't go away, folks. When we come back, we'll be announcing the name of the new capital city in Pennsylvania. It's probably a pretty funny line around the country, but not if you were here.
Michelle Lefevre-Quinn also struggled over the weekend.
I returned to my apartment in Hershey. I was an emotional wreck. I got up Saturday morning and went to my parents' house outside of Philadelphia, and I didn't know whether I'd return. I spent the weekend thinking about it. I just didn't know what to do, but I knew I had wanted to be a reporter, and if I didn't go back, I could never be a reporter again. So I got back in the car Sunday evening and was back on the news Monday and there for the duration of the incident.
The anger in these reporters over the way the story was handled and their resulting exposure because of it is still palpable today. Frank Goldstein.
There was terrible, terrible information diffusion and cover-up by the three main characters, if you will, in Three Mile Island. Everybody was telling us something different, and we really didn't know who to believe. The information coming out of Harrisburg and Middletown and Three Mile Island and the companies didn't want anything to get out, so they're not doing news releases. And I'm not sure that very many, if any, of the government agencies really wanted anything to get out, because we, thank God, didn't have to establish a new capital for Pennsylvania.
Mordant humor can help us get through difficult situations. But what is the truth of what happens as a result of radiation exposure? That's where the other half of the panel filled in the picture. We'll have that information for you in just a moment. But first, I want to thank all of you who contributed so generously to help me get to Harrisburg for the Three Mile Island anniversary. The good news is that we have Houston achieved break-even, for which I'm deeply grateful. But the show itself continues to have its regular monthly expenses. Far be it for online production, dissemination, and storage of this program to be free, though there is no cost to you, the listeners. Nuclear Hot Seat is supported exclusively by the generosity of listeners like you. So please, won't you take a minute to help us out? If you can, make a donation of any size. It all counts. It all helps. You can do so by going to nuclearhotseat.com and clicking on the big red donate button. And if you wish to make a continuing donation of just $5 a month, we like to refer to that as the Starbucks donation. Not that the corporation gets the money, but it's about the same as you'd pay for a cup of coffee. If you'd like to make that kind of a donation, $5 a month, there's a big green donate button where you can easily set that up. Your support now and throughout the year will help us keep bringing you the best, most up-to-date information on what's going on with nuclear issues around the world. So, thank you for listening, thank you for caring, and know that whatever you can do to help us grow our reach into the world, you have my gratitude. Now back to our special, Three Mile Island at 39. WTF actually happened to us. First, we hear from Cindy Folkers. She is radiation health specialist at Beyond Nuclear. Cindy was very clear about the fact that she is not in health per se, and she is not a researcher in the lab. But she is someone who studies primary research and tries to glean out of it the information that can help people in these exposure scenarios.
What happens when we are exposed to radiation? It leaves traces in our bodies. Okay, it changes our biology, and some of these changes can be measured. Some of these changes repair themselves, some try to repair themselves and they repair poorly, and some of them can't repair at all. Some of these affect just the person who was exposed. Some of them can affect the person who was exposed and any offspring. So future generations can be impacted. So when you're dealing with something called a biomarker, and I suppose that the more technically correct term is a bioindicator, that's what we call a somatic impact. So what that means is that impact is usually just for that person that was exposed. So there are some of those that you can measure. It is best done much sooner after exposure so that the signal is louder, so that you can see it, because your body starts to repair it right away. And there are lots of different types of these biomarkers. They have been used historically in some populations that have been exposed to radiation in different ways. And depending on how you're exposed, the type of radiation you're exposed to, the duration of the exposure, whether it's an internal or external exposure, these can all matter when trying to measure biomarkers. So this is not a hard and fast tool. It's not a solution by any means. They can be tricky tests. They're expensive tests, although some of the cost has gone down with the technological advancements.
As regards what happened at Three Mile Island as a result of the accident, Cindy had this to say.
In, I think it was 1997, Dr. Stephen Wing, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, did an epidemiological study. He did it in the plume pathways that he thought were most likely to have caused the most exposure. So I'm assuming they're the same ones that you're talking about, but I don't know that for sure. He found within those pathways increases in lung cancers and leukemias. Now, I will also tell you that as part of that study, and this is what got me on the whole, well, maybe we should actually take a look at what's happening with the biology rather than trying to do dose reconstructions with error-ridden formulas, which is what they always do. And then, you know, they spread it out among a number of people who probably didn't get the dose. And so then all of a sudden your dose is 1.4 millisievert. 1.4 millirem, I think, is what they said. So they're still using, NRC, by the way, is still using the Three Mile Island accident to say that there's no problem. Just to let you know what the official status is, and they have the doses of this population who was exposed so low that it looks like there wouldn't be a problem. But the real truth of it is in that Steve Wing study. And in that study, they drew blood, they looked at one of these biomarkers. It was a biomarker that is actually specifically induced by radioactivity, and they found, long story short, that the people in those plume pathways were exposed to 60 to 90 rads of radiation. That is a huge...
REMs?
REM rad. It's the same as this gamma, yeah. It's an external dose. It's the same in this particular instance. That is to me, that's a huge dose. You may get a health physicist somewhere that's going to say, that's not a big deal. But for a developing fetus, that is a really huge dose. And for anybody, that's a really huge dose. And it was imparted over, I don't know how many hours or days, but it's still a really huge dose in a really small amount of time. And in order to determine that, they took this blood to look at this biomarker 15 years after those people had been exposed. And these were people who complained of the skin reddening, hair loss, diarrhea, metallic taste in the mouth. So this is what was discovered when the biology was actually looked at.
Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear. Heidi Huttner, Ph.D., is Director of Sustainability Studies and Associate Dean at the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University in New York. She spoke to how issues of gender and race can skew our understanding of the data of radiation exposure.
My particular research is focused on what happens to women's bodies, what happens to babies' bodies, and as it turns out, and this is now part of kind of more common knowledge in the anti-nuclear community and in the science, is that it turns out women are twice as likely to get cancer from the same exposure as an adult male, and almost twice as likely to die from that exposure as an adult male. So it is significant, it is important. And with children, it's 5 to 7 times. And it's most likely, you know, it gets, the younger the child is, the more dangerous it is. And for fetuses, most of all. And we know that from Alice Stewart's work, a single X-ray to the womb doubles that child's chances of developing cancer. So that's significant here because we know there are issues with children that were in the womb at the time of the accident, and we know with babies there are issues. So that's my focus, that's my research, and I'm writing about it now.
Heidi went on to explain how our understanding of the impact of radiation exposure on our health is skewed from the get-go.
Women are twice as likely to get cancer from the same exposure to radiation as an adult white male. And I say white because that's all we know right now. And that is significant because that is an environmental injustice. It means we don't even know what radiation does in what proportion to people of color. And we should know that. And secondarily, children are most susceptible, most vulnerable to radiation exposures, and the younger they are, the more vulnerable. So what's really tricky in this is that our safety regulations are based on this adult white male body. So if you're a woman working in a nuclear power plant or in the nuclear industry and you're exposed to radiation and they've decided whatever number is acceptable and isn't dangerous, that number really should be doubled to protect the women. Now, what happens if a woman gets pregnant and she's working there? Maybe she doesn't even know. And there's a whole kind of gender issue there where that's not fair. A woman might lose a job if she really needs it because she's a woman. So it's a fine line there in terms of wanting to do this. But we know that if a woman is pregnant and working in a facility, not only is she more vulnerable, but that fetus is even more vulnerable. This is an issue worldwide.
Heidi Huttner. Also on the panel was Dr. Renu Joshi. She is an endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism specialist with a practice in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Dr. Joshi explains why she started studying thyroid cancers in the Harrisburg area.
The reason I'm here is because my interest sparked when I started to see a lot more thyroid cancer patients, and they just behave differently than the rest of the world, or rest of the nation, I must say. So my interest was enough that I decided to do our own study and research on our own thyroid cancer patient, which was presented at a national meeting 3 years ago about the effect of TMI on thyroid cancer and thyroid nodules in general.
Dr. Joshi then offered a devastating analysis of the data she discovered in her Harrisburg area practice.
When we did our endocrinology fellowship and when we did our medical school, it has been taught and ingrained in our brains that whenever there's radiation, there's an increased risk of cancer, especially in children. And that data came long ago from Chernobyl accident, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. You know, we had that data long ago. So when I did my endocrinology fellowship, we were told that if you had any radiation history, you would be more vigilant for these people to look for thyroid nodules, to look for thyroid cancer. And if you did an ultrasound and you found a thyroid nodule, you'll be more vigilant to follow them every 6 months, every year, to make sure they don't grow or they don't develop in cancer. In fact, one of our biggest questions to even today is, did you have your tonsil irradiated? And in those days, a lot of kids got tonsil irradiation, and even that was enough to develop thyroid nodules, and these nodules are more pronounced and more prominent to be developing into thyroid cancers later. So as I started to build up my practice in Pinnacle back in 2000, I started to see some patterns. Now, for those of you who do not know, we always talk to our patients saying that thyroid cancer is one cancer you want in life because it does not kill anybody and it does not cause any problems. So you can live a normal life with thyroid cancer. So when I started seeing some patterns, I said, why are some of these patients have such high-risk thyroid cancers? They're coming back, they're spreading. I don't know this about thyroid cancer. Mayo Clinic does not show this data, nor does the Texas data shows this. So why is that? So I started doing research and looking in, and 2008, there was actually an article published from Department of Health based on all the thyroid registries and cancer registry data, and they looked at the TMI, and they actually did not find any relationship between TMI and thyroid cancer. But that still did not satisfy us because I had by that time developed a huge practice. So we did our own study. I looked at 300 thyroid cancer patients I had built up in the last 15 years. And we studied them where they resided in the last 15 years, where they were living now. And we asked the question, where were they in 1979 when the TMI happened? And then we identified the patterns of thyroid cancer. And again, all of you, I must tell you, thyroid cancer is low risk, 70, 80, 90% of the time. So what we found was out of 300 patients, we had roughly 20 to 22 patients who had high risk or intermediate risk thyroid cancer, which means they were spreading and they were coming back with recurrence. When we looked at the recurrence data, the recurrence was not different than the nation. It was 6.3%, which is the national average. But two things stood out. One thing, our patients with recurrence were at the age of 42, while the national average is 47. So we found that the population in Harrisburg was a little younger when they recurred and had a high-risk thyroid cancer. The second thing which we found, which I found very surprising, there's a special type of thyroid cancer which is called Hürthle cell thyroid cancer. And if anybody has it, it's a little bit more aggressive and it does not respond to the usual treatment. And the national average of that Hürthle cell thyroid cancer is 5%. We found in the Harrisburg-Yonge-Lancaster area to be 10.2%. So it was almost double than the national average. Again, I am just going to give you the data I have. I did not go back and look at biological markers, molecular markers to see why they had this. This was just a study. We looked at the charts and we called the patients. So these two differences were really different and we were amazed by these differences. The third thing which we found, out of the 22 patients who had intermediate and high-risk thyroid cancer, 65 to 70% lived within 15 miles of TMI. So I don't know how to make that correlation because, as I said, there are two papers back in 2008 and 2010 which talk about there was no correlation, but I think there are two recent papers just published in Laryngoscope last year, and they're starting to talk that there is a slight increased risk of thyroid cancer in the TMI population. So I think the data we studied appears to be true, that there is indeed an effect of TMI on the kind of thyroid cancer, on the aggressiveness of thyroid cancer, and the age of thyroid cancer.
Then came the questions from the floor. As people, ordinary people who had just come in for the information, opened themselves up to ask questions that had haunted them and for which they hoped to get some answers.
I myself was 4 months in utero when the Three Mile Island accident happened. I was born with clubfoot disorder, severe, one of the worst cases that doctors on the East Coast had ever seen. And then 20 years later, crazy health issues started happening. My question is, what do we say to our doctors who are convinced that these health issues are something we did to our bodies and they think we're lying? When I go meet with doctors and try to say, I don't know why this is happening to me, and when they ask me to explain to them what happened, and I say the only thing I can think of is this exposure to when Three Mile Island occurred, and I'm lucky I don't end up in the psych unit. So do you have ideas or recommendations on how to talk to physicians about this?
I think this is a great question, and I can tell you, being 25 years in the practice, I was probably like that doctor 20 years ago, where there's nothing wrong with you, and all of this is in your head. You know, we all were learned and taught that way, that, you know, if you can't find an answer, which means the patient doesn't have a problem. Little that I've learned in 20 years, that if I can't answer your question, that means I just don't know enough, which means there's a lot more out there we don't know about. And I looked and researched TMI, and yes, there's a lot of data on radiation causing cancer, causing fibromyalgia, causing thyroiditis, causing autoimmune disease. Tons of data. But the problem is nobody puts it together. Chernobyl data is actually much more than the TMI. So most of my experience actually comes from Chernobyl. And so I put the same data and put it to TMI. So if my patient would complain, hey, maybe there's something which is related, but I just don't know the answer because there's not enough data published.
Maria Frisbee is a cousin of Robert Reed, who was mayor of Middletown during the 1979 nuclear accident.
I live in Middletown, Pennsylvania, and I lived in Middletown, Pennsylvania when we had the partial meltdown at Three Mile Island. When I was picked up at my high school, when I went outside, I had a strong metallic taste in my mouth, and I knew that that was highly abnormal. And I do believe, because they had uncontrolled releases of radioactive gases into the air, that is the reason why I and so many people tasted metal. And I have so many health issues. My organs were starting to shut down or not work well. I have an ovarian mass in my body right now. My gallbladder stopped working and the doctors didn't know why. And then my appendix stopped working. So they had these doctors examining me, and they were trying to figure out why are my organs not working well. I do believe that we were affected. There is a high cancer cluster in the Middletown, Pennsylvania area and the surrounding areas. And I'm thinking about what the one lady said there about your offspring. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, can your eggs be affected? And the reason I'm asking you that is because my son, he has autism.
Cindy Folkers fielded the response.
There's something that I can share with you. When this researcher was looking into cross-generational impacts, so offspring, he found that indeed there is cross-generational impact and that removal from the area of contamination doesn't necessarily get rid of it. And he has, up to now, mostly done insects. He has a human study, and I can't share anything with you yet because it's not been published. But the impacts that you're talking about are showing up potentially. And these impacts, when you do the sort of genetic profile testing, some of these genetic impacts can be very subtle. They can result in what are called subclinical impacts, meaning that you might not perform as well in school, you might have behavioral issues. Sometimes they'll pop up generations down the road because a lot of them are recessive. But the problem is that these things can assimilate and compound. And so the most important thing is to stop the exposures as quickly as possible when you're looking at generational impacts. I hope that helps.
Thank you very much for your information, because I thought that I did something wrong when it came to my son having autism and whatnot. I thought I did something wrong, and maybe it's associated because I was affected, you know, by the radioactive gases. You know.
It would be hard to know for sure for me sitting here to tell you that for sure, but you can have cross-generational impacts from the kind of exposure that the community around Three Mile Island incurred. It is possible.
Okay. Heidi Huttner elaborated on how women in particular are shut up and shut out of the nuclear conversation.
So one of the things we're looking at is something called radiophobia, which we believe is basically an invented term to shut women up, because it's women who are accused of being hysterical. I've heard your go home and bake cookies story. What do you know? Go home, little lady. You couldn't possibly understand the science or nuclear technology, because the women that they, you know, that get upset for their children, they want to protect them, and they might go speak up. In a lot of cases here, you have your mothers and concerned women who went to these meetings with the NRC, and they're told you can't possibly get it, right? So it's a way of shutting them up. Okay, that's, you could say, well, that's unfair, but there's more to it. If they're shut up and if they're talked into it, that means they're not going to go to the doctor when they suspect symptoms. And if you don't go right away when you have cancer, you are at greater risk. And if you're thinking and doubting yourself, you're not going to go to the doctor. So, you know, you can spin this out, but there's so many gender issues here. And obviously, that could happen, your husband's sick, but you say, well, we're just imagining it, right? And you convince the women. And this radiophobia goes back to the term hysteria, right? Much earlier times, and you're just telling women, oh, it's just all in your head. And it's not to say there wasn't stress. We know there's PTSD, but that doesn't mean your fear isn't justified.
As for trying to talk about that fear with medical doctors, Michelle Lefevre-Quinn had her own story.
In the 90s, I was going to see a new physician. I live in Delaware now. And he was taking my history, medical history. Did you smoke? Did you drink? Can you think of anything else that I should know about your history? And I said, well, I was at TMI and I covered it. And he was younger than me. I was probably in my late 30s. And he laughed at me. And so then I thought, well, I guess I should let it go. And now when I see what's happening from joining this group, it's so much more out there. And it's our job to get the story out.
It is vital to get this story out, whether, as Frank Goldstein mentioned, because international journalists were on site and they need to know what has happened in the wake of their exposure at Three Mile Island, or, as Heidi Huttner pointed out quite eloquently, the nuclear industry loves to come in the wake of any of their disasters and radioactive sites and normalize the communities by building homes, building schools, putting in nature parks, and completely erasing, if they possibly can, any history of a nuclear event, a nuclear contamination event, that might have happened. That discussion led to this question.
With the upcoming commissioning of Three Mile Island, if left unchecked, do you see something similar for that land?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's still dangerous. Today it's dangerous. I mean, you all know this. It continues to be dangerous. That the plant you have is still releasing, but you go ahead.
And if you have a decommissioned nuclear reactor site, you have to be very careful about tritium leakage. One of the researchers that I collaborate with, even after everything's been removed, if there's part of the facility that was there that absorbed radioactive hydrogen, which is produced in these facilities.
Like the old hydrogen bubble?
Yeah, right. Well, then I don't know if that hydrogen was radioactive or not. I'd have to go back and look in the whole literature. But it can, if it absorbed tritium during its functioning days, they can say it's decommissioned, they can leave it and not be watching what's going on or monitoring anything, and you can have tritium leak out of the site, even after it's quote-unquote done.
You know, you can shut the plant down.
Mm-hmm.
But they remain dangerous locations into perpetuity. Some of that material for a million years, some of it for hundreds of thousands of years, and you just keep building pretty little houses around them and nobody thinks about it. It's psychologically. So if you don't change that terrain to make it clear, this is a dangerous place, move people out, move the housing away, it definitely normalizes it.
That was Heidi Huttner, and commenting before her, Cindy Folkers. The panel ended, and the evening broke down into casual conversations around the room. I spoke with several TMI survivors, those recently claiming that title, who opened up to talk of cancers, autoimmune diseases, illnesses, deaths, miscarriages, and more. Many of these people were newly politicized to what had happened to them or their families starting 39 years ago. A lot of them appeared shell-shocked by this new information, the validation of their worst fears. I can only hope that they take whatever energy and emotion was released as a result of the panel discussion's information and use it to join in actions that will mandate as good a cleanup as possible of the remaining site, necessary medical follow-ups, and blocking any whitewash of a newly built suburbia on this forever deadly site. As for me, ultimately this trip was about facing my personal demons, and that's this week's final thought. Visiting the site of the Three Mile Island nuclear reactors provided me with quite the emotional roller coaster. If you've ever experienced a trauma and then had to revisit the scene where it happened or the means by which it happened, say, driving a car after a bad accident, or returning to a childhood home after the death of an abusive parent, you know the shocking intensity of emotion that can make itself known, almost a flashback to the moment when the worst that could happen actually did happen. That's what happened for me. Much of what I experienced upon this return to Three Mile Island I can't yet talk about, as I'm still processing all that came up for me and remains active. But I can tell you this. Driving towards the actual cooling towers, as they emerged from the mist and fog, I physically convulsed with an emotional force that almost decked me. Emotions and associations repressed for almost four decades came roaring out as something that had existed only in my memory became a physical reality. There it was, right here. The Three Mile Island reactors and cooling towers, up close and personal, right where I'd left them, and all the ancient fears were still intact. Over my 2 days in Middletown, I returned again and again to where I could see those cooling towers from different perspectives, letting each one trigger me into a different set of emotions. And yes, I found the house I stayed in, and that was a trip in itself. I took pictures to match up with the ones I had taken 39 years ago, when as a stupid young woman, I posed with nuclear reactor cooling towers behind me that weren't yet known to be safe. In for a penny, in for a pound, that's what I thought at the time. Did you ever want to go back in time and smack your younger self upside the head? If I could have, I would have. As for the panel discussion, the information I gained from it proved life-changing. For all my coverage of nuclear issues during this first almost 7 years of Nuclear Hot Seat, I still learned things about Three Mile Island I'd never heard before. Of particular breathtaking import was Cindy Folker's information on subclinical health problems, those problems that may not be diagnosable as diseases, but still impact life, health, longevity, energy, and maybe even my adrenal gland problem. Cindy and I followed up with a breakfast meeting the next day, and the profound nature of her information continues to rock my world. I'll be writing about it in some detail in my upcoming book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from 3 Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat. And I am planning to have an extended interview with Cindy on her findings for a future episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. Having attended 3 Mile Island at 39, I am committed to returning next year for the big one, the big 4-0, TMI at 40. As I've pointed out often on this show, the news media tends to ignore historic events except for anniversaries that end in a 5 or a 0. 4 decades after the nuclear meltdown at 3 Mile Island, and can we stop spin-speaking it as a partial meltdown? That's like saying you're partly pregnant. Part of the fuel melted. It was a meltdown. Get used to it. So here we are, coming up on 40 years after the meltdown at 3 Mile Island. And I am pledged to helping make TMI at 40 as big a contradiction to the nuclear industry's lies as possible. Details to follow. Anyone want to help? Meanwhile, stay tuned to Nuclear Hot Seat for further updates on 3 Mile Island and all the rest of the nuclear mess that we've gotten ourselves into. Nuclear is a dirty, dangerous industry that has conned us into believing that we need it, that it's clean, green, and sustainable, when all that's sustainable about nuclear is the 24,000-year half-life of plutonium that's created at every functioning nuclear reactor, and the damage it does to our health and our lives all the way down to our DNA. The nuclear industry takes many forms, from uranium mining to reactors to bombs to improperly, if not illegally, dumped and transported radioactive waste products. If that makes you angry, if 3 Mile Island makes you angry, keep listening. We'll help you find ways to get involved. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 10, 2018. My thanks first to the producers of the panel discussion of TMI at 39, Stacy Griffiths, Christine Lehman, and Joe Rodriguez. If you were in the Middletown-Harrisburg area during the nuclear accident at 3 Mile Island and have experienced or know others who have experienced suspicious medical issues as a result, I urge you to sign on to the Facebook group 3 Mile Island Survivors. More than 4,000 people already belong to that group and identify with that label, and it's where you need to be. I will have a link up to it on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 355. My gratitude and respect to the panel members, Heidi Huttner, Cindy Folkers, and Dr. Renu Joshi, for their ongoing research into the medical impact of 3 Mile Island, and broadcasters Frank Goldstein, Dan Steele, and David Sollenberger, a former CBS reporter who covered the 3 Mile Island story through 1983. My personal thanks to Scott Portsline of 3 Mile Island Alert, who helped me improve the audio quality from the panel discussion. And once again, gratitude to those of you who contributed so generously to make this trip possible. For those of you who want more information, I will link to the late Stephen Wing's report on the TMI epidemiological study on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 355, And there will also be a link to Three Mile Island Alert at tmia.org. Please go read their materials, learn more. Don't be shy and don't be scared. Get informed, get mad, get active. It's the only thing that helps. Here's a shout out to the Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world. 123 countries on 6 continents and counting, plus everyone who's listening on our growing network of broadcast stations in the U.S. through the Pacifica Audio Port Network. You are the ones who show your love for life on this planet by being the kick-ass defenders of nuclear truth and supporters of atomic awareness that you are. Thank you for visiting the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat blog page and podcast page. If you haven't yet, be sure to stop by, click like, follow us, post, and share. To find all of our back episodes, 354 of them and counting, go to nuclearhotseat.com. And with that URL, if you put in /blog, you will be able to scan back 10 episodes at a time. It helps if you're trying to find one of the recent stories. Two of them that you might find of interest if you're following the Three Mile Island issues. Episode 353 is my annual TMI anniversary show. And 354 features an interview with epidemiologist Joseph Mangano that includes information on increased cancer rates around nuclear reactors, including Three Mile Island. Theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, accompaniment by John Barnard, recorded at Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood. Never miss an episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. Have it delivered via email every week by going to nuclearhotseat.com. Look for the yellow box and sign up with your first name and email address. I won't bug you with email, I promise. It's once a week and it's just for the show. And as a bonus, you will receive a sample chapter from my book, which is going to be published this spring. Yes, I glow in the dark. It's the chapter about me on the ground, 1 mile away from the nuclear reactor, when the loudspeaker coming down the road announced the end of my life as I knew it. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2018. Libby, Halevy, and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We will really appreciate your support. This is Libby Halevy of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating. Reminding you, while the nuclear industry likes to crow, nobody died at Three Mile Island. That doesn't mean people didn't die from Three Mile Island and its effects. And they are still dying today. There you've got it. Your own personal nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.